So our first speaker today will be Kay Holkamp. She's a professor in the zoology department and director of the program in ecology, evolutionary biology, and behavior at Michigan State University. She's a leading expert on the behavior, development, and evolution of spotted hyenas, which, as she's shown, live in complex societies that are in many ways remarkably similar to those of primates. And she's done a great deal to rehabilitate, I think, the public image of this extraordinary animal. And as one Detroit Free Press article on her writes, Kay Holkamp has spent her life with a bunch of hyenas, and she's loved every minute of the journey. Please welcome Kay, who will tell us about the evolution of problem-solving abilities in mammalian carnivores. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Russell. It's very sweet of you guys to invite me for this. This is, I think, a lot of fun. I see we're going backwards instead of forward. Let me start at the beginning. Okay, what I wanted to do today briefly was to actually take you on what for me has turned into an intellectual journey trying to understand the evolution of problem solving in mammalian carnivores. And I just need to remind you that neural tissue is very expensive. Brains are metabolically tremendously costly, and nevertheless, mammals have relatively large brains for their body size, and relative even to other mammals, primates tend to have large brains, larger cortexes, cortex, and sophisticated cognition. So the question is, why? What are the selective pressures that have generated this sort of expensive thinking organ? There are a number of hypotheses that have been put forward in the literature. The first one suggested, this is all based on observations like Jane Goodall's of chimpanzees fishing with sticks to catch termites, that perhaps large brains evolved to cope with complexity in the physical environment. This might involve finding food in a variable environment or navigating in it with a heavy body through a complex three-dimensional world, or extracting food like Jane Goodall's chimpanzees or this West African chimpanzee. This one that you had a lot of chance to look at already suggests that it's actually social complexity that favors the evolution of large brains and great intelligence. And this is the notion here is simply that if you can outwit or outthink your groupmates, you may not have to engage in challenging and perhaps even dangerous interactions of this sort. And then very recently, Daniel Sala suggested the cognitive buffer hypothesis, which posits that large brains evolved to allow animals to cope with novel socio-ecological challenges. And so you can see that that brings together elements from both of the previous two hypotheses, but his emphasis is on novelty animals adapting to changing environments and that minimizing their mortality, as in these Indian langurs. So I set out quite a while ago with my students and colleagues to try to test the social complexity hypothesis. And the logic here was very simple, that if the big brains found in primates were favored by social complexity, then we ought to see in non-primates living in primate-like societies the same kinds of cognitive abilities and brain features that we see in primates. And as Russell just mentioned, we work with spotted hyenas, which really are sort of remarkably primate-like in their societies. They live in big, stable social groups called clans, and all the members of a clan know one another individually. Together, they defend a common territory, and they all rear their cubs together. But surprisingly, their societies just don't look anything like the society of any other gregarious carnivore that you can think of. These are all living in relatively small groups comprised of relatively close kin. Instead, spotted hyena societies look much more like the troops of baboons or other cercopithecine primates. And so we see that in contrast to all the other gregarious carnivores, hyenas live in groups where, yes, they have some kin, but also they're living in groups that are comprised largely of animals that are no more closely related than I am to any of you. So we have multiple overlapping generations in both of these taxonomic groups in the social groups. We have multiple adults of both sexes, male dispersal and female filipatry. We see kin associating within subgroups within the larger societies, and both societies are structured by hierarchical rank relationships. So if you want to stay within the mammals, these animals last shared a common ancestor roughly 95 million years ago, and so this is about as independent a test as you can get of the social complexity hypothesis. We work with these animals in the Maasai Mara National Reserve in southwest Kenya. This is an area of open rolling grassland that's grazed by lots of large herbivores, so that supports lots of carnivores. And we actually work on a number of different hyena clans that we recognize each individual animal by its unique spots and ear damage, and we spend a lot of hours every day sitting in cars like that one to which the hyenas are very well habituated. And one of the things that we've recorded very religiously since the beginning of our study in the late 80s is all social interactions of this sort. And what you're seeing here is a low-level fight between these two hyenas. You can actually see from the body language, ears back, tails down, between the legs and so forth, that that animal on the right is losing this fight, animal on the left is winning it. And you can see their body language is very similar to what you find in domestic dogs and cats, for that matter. But because we've recorded every occurrence of that that's taken place in our presence for something like 27 years, we can actually generate a very clear picture of the social structure in any given time interval within the larger study. So what I've done here is to show you a dominance hierarchy within one of our clans. The winners in these fights are listed here, going from the animal who can win against everybody else down to Boston who can't win against anyone else. And the same individuals are listed as losers in this fight, in these fights up here, and all the numbers in the matrix just represent the number of dyadic fights that we've seen where there was a clear winner and a clear loser. And for simplification purposes, I took out about 50 hyenas here between Bailey and Midget so that you could see what was going on. But what you can see, I think, is that this is a very linear, rigid hierarchy, much like what you'd find in a group of cercopithecine primates, with an interesting exception, which is that the females in the spotted hyenas are socially dominant to all the breeding males, which have come in from elsewhere, and they are down at the very bottom of hyena society, sadly for them. In addition to looking structurally like a hyena society, we find that actually these individuals, as they're growing up in the society, learn their ranks, and so they slot in immediately below their mothers in this overall ranking, and that both individuals and matrilines have rank, just like in a monkey troop. So we have these three individuals who are sisters, these individuals who are sisters, and so forth. They occupy adjacent positions in the hierarchy. In addition, patterns of resource competition are much like what we find in primates, even though what they're competing over is different, obviously. But what we find is that the outcomes of these competitions have effects on reproductive success. And here I'm just showing you a couple of quick examples. It really doesn't make any difference in hyenas which index of reproductive success you look at. Here we're looking at offspring produced per year. Here we're looking at age at which they first give birth, and the ranks are on the horizontal axis going from high, over here by convention, highest ranking one is number one, out to these low ranking individuals. And what you can see, I think, is that high ranking individuals are producing more offspring per year, and they're starting to breed at younger ages, so they have longer lifespans. This has a profound effect on fitness when you watch these animals over multiple generations. So given all these similarities in group size, composition and structure, life history pattern, social development, rank determining priority of access to resources, and fitness consequences of social rank, we were interested to know, are there also similarities in social cognition? Has there been convergent evolution? So I'm now going to summarize about 20 years worth of work in two slides by telling you, yes, the bottom line is, yes, we do see amazing similarities in the domain of social cognition. So we find, what we've done, let me just tell you strategically what we did was, the primatologists would publish something in the literature saying, okay, we just went out and asked our monkeys if they can do this particular social cognitive feat, and then we would go out and try and emulate their methods as much as possible, and yes, in every case that we've asked them so far, the hyenas can do what monkeys can do in the social domain. So they actually recognize each other individually based on multiple sensory modalities. They actually reconcile after fights, so that that allows them to repair damaged social bonds. They hang out in kin-based biased associations within the larger group, and they exhibit a lot of nepotistic behavior. They recognize paternal as well as maternal kin, which is also characteristic of baboons. They actually join forces to accomplish a lot of different social goals, just like monkeys do. They recognize third-party relationships based on both rank and kinship, just like baboons. They recognize that social partners vary in their relative value, and they make decisions about who to associate with based on that relative value. And they also are clearly tracking a great deal of information about their environments and using it to make adaptive social decisions. And just so that you get an idea of sort of how we go about knowing these things, I wanted to show you a little bit of data germane to those last two points here. Here I'm showing you the association bond strength between adult males and adult females in spotted hyena society. So that's an index measured here. It just basically tells you how closely two individuals associate. And we've got, again, female rank on the horizontal axis, But I need to tell you that males are the initiators of all of these interactions. Females could not possibly be more indifferent to the presence of males. So the males are actually making these decisions about which females to spend time with. And as you can see, we have no idea how they know this, but they know somehow that it's a better idea to hang out with these high-ranking individuals than with these low-ranking individuals. And that's adaptive for these males because if you actually look at the survivorship of the offspring born to these females, and by the way, the males who hang out with these females are the ones likeliest to father their cubs, we find that the offspring of low-ranking females don't survive nearly as well as do the females at this end of the hierarchy. Similarly, primatologists for a while thought coalition formation was unique to primates. That's definitely not right. A lot of animals, even crabs, do this, for example. But we actually see a lot of triadic and more complex interactions, like that one, that function in hyena society to attain and maintain social rank, but also to acquire and then defend resources. So we've done a couple of different studies of coalition formation in these animals, and what we did is to go to our data set of agonistic interactions and pick out all the cases where two individuals were having a fight, in this case A and B. And you can see, again, by the body language that B's losing this fight, A's winning it. So along comes X in the middle of this fight, this animal over here. It has to make two decisions. Do I join this fight at all? And if so, who do I join? So we were interested to know what variables predict whether or not X will join A here, and it turns out, I'm just showing you this in a pictorial format, but there are a number of different things that the animal seems to be taking into consideration when it makes that decision. So X is much likelier to join A if, in fact, X and A are close relatives than if they're unrelated. X takes advantage of its relationship with A to actually reinforce its own rank relationship with B. They're obviously taking the local ecological situation into account such that if there's food present in this immediate environment, X is much less likely to help A than if there is no food present. And X is clearly thinking about the audience that's present here because it's much less likely to join A if A has few relatives and B has a lot of relatives in the immediate environment. So in all of these respects, we actually find striking similarities in social cognition between spotted hyenas and Cercopithecine primates. So clearly, the data, behavioral data are all consistent with the social complexity hypothesis. So this led us to start thinking about the brain. And when you think about the social complexity hypothesis applied to brains, which is referred to as the social brain hypothesis, that's what Robin Dunbar calls it, we actually have a prediction that says that we ought to see convergent evolution in neural tissue as well, such that there should be expansion of the neural tissues that are mediating social behavior. Well, a lot of different parts of the brain are, of course, involved in the mediation of social behavior, but in particular, frontal cortex, the very anteriormost part of the cortical region, is it functions clearly in a lot of important social decision making in a lot of different species. So that is one of the things that we decided to look at. As you can see, the brains of carnivores look structurally a little bit different from the brains of primates. I guess that's what happens when they're separated by 95 million years. But in any case, what we did was, this is an effort spearheaded by my neuroanatomist colleague, Charlene Sakai, who instead of actually taking actual brains from carnivores, which are actually hard to come by, she would actually create virtual brains in three dimensions by putting skulls of hyenas and other species in a CT scanner and then creating from the slices generated by the CT scanner, virtual brains in three dimension, in which we can actually measure volumetric relationships. And we divide the brain into four crude regions, the olfactory bulbs, the anterior cerebrum, which is mostly frontal cortex, the posterior cerebrum, and then the brainstem and cerebellum. So we actually set out doing this by comparing the four extant hyena species on the surface of the earth. The only one that you've heard about so far is this one, but that's also the only gregarious one that lives in big groups and hunts large mammals. We have the aardwolf, a diminutive little hyena that is actually specialized for eating termites, and it spends its whole life being solitary except when it's breeding. We have striped and brown hyenas over here, which always forage alone, but they feed on carrion, but they may share dens with a close female relative or more than one in the case of brown hyenas. So we have basically very complicated sociality, sort of intermediate sociality, and really solitary. So I'm showing you here in two dimensions what we were trying to do in three dimensions with the virtual endocast. And if, in fact, the social brain hypothesis is correct, looking at the four extant hyenids, then we should see a decrease in frontal cortex volume, at least anterior cerebrum volume, relative to the overall endocranial space, going down from spotted hyenas with the largest, then the two intermediate species, to the aardwolf. And that's largely what we see. Overall brain size doesn't quite conform to predictions of the social complexity hypothesis, because we have the spotted hyena over here and the other three hyenas over here doing looking remarkably similar in their overall brain volume relative to the size of the skull from which they came. But in frontal cortex volume, we have spotted hyenas here, then brown, then striped, then aardwolves there. So that's more consistent with the social brain hypothesis, but it's also consistent with other hypotheses. So we conclude from all of this that whole brain and frontal cortex are both larger in spotted hyenas than in less gregarious hyenas. So these data, again, are consistent with the social brain hypothesis. And then we started wondering whether social selection pressures might be able to actually have an effect on general cognition as well as social cognition in particular. So to investigate this, we actually reinvented Thorndike's puzzle box in heavy metal here. We actually created these out of rebar, because hyenas can destroy pretty much anything they get their mouths on. Thorndike, you know, invented his during his dissertation work in the 19th century. Instead of the animals getting out of the box like Thorndike wanted to have happen, we had to actually ask the animals to get into the box to find a particular big yummy chunk of meat. And all they had to do in order to achieve this was simply to slide this bolt from right to left, and then the door would swing open. So we didn't care whether they opened it with their mouths, with their paws, by flipping the box around until it fell open, whatever. We actually conducted 354 trials on 59 individuals from three different study clans, and we found that certain performance indicators were predictive of whether or not individuals would be able to open this box. And the first one on top here was simply how many different behaviors the animal tried when it was interacting with the box for the first time. And so the animals who tried a lot of different behaviors were successful. The animals who didn't try very many were not, by comparison. The more persistent individuals were also more successful than less persistent animals, and the less neophobic ones, the ones who didn't hesitate to come up and approach the box in the first place, were also more successful. But what sort of really surprised me was this is the most gregarious of all the carnivores, and nevertheless, only 9 individuals managed to ever open this box out of the 59 subjects that we exposed to the box. And so what we decided to do was look more broadly at carnivores in general. So we actually then went on to test all these different species. Obviously, we didn't do this in nature because that would have been impossible. But what we did do was go to 9 different North American zoos. And in the zoos, we actually tested 153 individuals from 41 species in 9 families. And here they are. The 9 families are the civet family, the mongoose family, hyena family, cat family, dog family, bear family, panda family, raccoon family, and the weasel family. And here was how we did this experiment. We actually generated multiple boxes of different sizes, and we then could present boxes that were scaled to body size for each carnivore tested, because those range in size from pretty small to enormous. And we actually tested all the individuals in their home enclosure, and what we did was to ask the keeper, what is this animal's favorite food? Keepers know this stuff because they need to get the animals motivated to move around within from one enclosure to another and do other husbandry tasks, and so the baits varied. We just gave each individual what the keeper knew it liked best, and these things ranged from dead baby goats to chunks of meat to bamboo, or mealworms, whatever. We gave it what it liked. And here's how we did this. We videotaped every trial. We would actually get the animal out of its home enclosure for a couple minutes while we set up the box and put the latch to the bolt at right angles to the ground and to the box itself. And then we would videotape every trial and extract the same measures of performance that we used originally. And then we also asked whether success in opening the box was predicted by any of these kinds of measures. So these performance measures, life history variables, whether or not it was gregarious, what it ate, manual dexterity, various neuroanatomical features as well. So we actually put all of this together in a Bayesian phylogenetic generalized linear model using to try to understand what predicts success in opening the puzzle box. And I want to actually take a minute to show you what this looked like. So some of these animals you're seeing, it's already had a couple of trials. Most individuals had at least three trials. Here's a red panda going after bamboo. It's not a hard puzzle. Binturong going after a fish. This bear, these bears always strike me as sort of remarkably thoughtful if you were going to anthropomorphize. Sometimes they're so surprised when they actually get it open. It's amusing. This was this individual's first trial, and then you're going to see a clip of it after it's figured out what to do. This guy's never did get the box open.
What species is that?
Striped hyena. This is a spotted hyena now. This badger suddenly realizes, oh, I got it open.
You know, it looks simple, but this must have been logistically terribly complicated.
It took us a year or more just to get the permissions from the various Iukaks that we had to get the permissions from. It was really painful. But you know, fun. And there are very few, you know, big comparative experiments done like this. McLean et al. Did one where they had a lot of different investigators actually applying the same test to a lot of different species around the world, actually. But this is just, you know, a single set of people doing this whole thing. And our personal favorite, the wolverine, who first tries to take this thing into its water tank and then... and then it decides to take it home.
What's its food?
This one, I think it was just a chunk of meat, frankly. I can't honestly remember.
Have you tried wild gray squirrel?
Wild gray squirrel, no, but I bet they'd do well, wouldn't they? Okay, anyway, you guys get the idea here.
I'm going to say the octopus would take about 30 seconds.
Yeah, no, I bet that's right. I'm dying to hear more about that. Okay, so you get the idea what we did, and I'm showing you here the results. The animals that are bolded, actually, at least one member of the species managed to get the thing open. I'm almost done here. We saw, as you might expect, an isomorphic relationship between brain size and body size. No surprises there. But what was surprising was that of all of the variables that we were looking at, even although sociality was included in the best model, nothing except brain size predicted whether or not these animals were actually going to open the box. We actually looked at sociality in two different ways. We had a continuous measure based on mean group size for the species and also just a binary measure saying, do you live by yourself or with other conspecifics? And in neither case did that have any significant predictive power for whether or not you open the box. So from all this, we conclude that social complexity does appear to promote convergence in the evolution in carnivores, at least, of social problem solving. There are hints that perhaps it also affects brain regions in their evolution. But it looks like big brains really are good for something. They actually help you solve problems in your life. And with that, I will stop and thank all the wonderful people who have helped with all of this work, particularly my co-conspirators on the Big Zoo study, which is Ben Dancer, Sarah Benson-Amram, and Eli Swanson. Thanks a lot.